Welcome back to the program. As we focus our attention on the subject of work, it is what we spend most of our time doing. It defines us. It gives us meaning. But in fact, very little has been written about the rewards and the frustrations of work. We're going to talk about it today with a guest that has been with us before. It is always a pleasure and an honor to have him back. He is Alain de Botton. He's the author of the previous books, How Proust Can Change Your Life and The Architecture of Happiness. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his new book, The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. Alain de Botton, welcome to the program. Great to have you here. One of the things that certainly you point out is that, in fact, very little over the years has been written really focusing on the subject of work, the rewards of work, the frustrations, and yet it is what we spend most of our time doing. Why do you think there has been that lack of focus in terms of thinking about the big ideas with respect to work?
I think it reflects a general a prejudice against what you could call working life in literature. You know, if you were a Martian and you were taken to a Barnes & Noble or wherever and asked to try and understand the human race just by reading what was on the front table, you'd come away thinking that basically human beings spend most of their time, having love affairs, sometimes squabbling with their families, or murdering one another, but not really going to work, going to the office, going to the factory. And I think that's a kind of prejudice that sometimes reflects how writers actually live. On the whole, nowadays, in order to be a writer, you can't do it part-time, it's very hard for people to do it part-time. It's a kind of, like most jobs, it's become a specialized full-time occupation, which leaves most writers with a lot of experience of emotional life, but maybe a lot less experience of kind of working life. And that's a prejudice that has impacted on what gets written.
What's interesting, though, is that if you go a little deeper into that Barnes & Noble, there'll be shelves and shelves and shelves filled with books about business, but not necessarily about work.
That's right. I think you're right to make a distinction between business and work, because business is the economic way of looking at the workplace. And we're, of course, very used to that way of looking at things. It's a kind of, it's really suggesting that the whole point of work is money, which, of course, is absolutely central, but it's not the only thing. It doesn't capture all the value. When you look at the stock market price of a company, you're looking at a snapshot of one aspect of what that company is doing. You're not really thinking about, what the atmosphere is like at 3 p.m., in the Honeywell offices or at the offices of, SAP or whatever. It's that kind of human reality that I think is fascinating. And that's there. Whenever we meet someone new and we say to them, what do you do? Often we're trying to understand how they spend their day, what the kind of texture of their life is like through their work.
Right. I mean, it is the first question that people tend to ask, what do you do? And yet it never relates to what they do as it impacts other people and as it relates to other people.
I mean, you're right. It's a very painful question, of course, to have to answer, because for many of us, we're not actually doing what we want to be doing. Behind that question, when people say, what do you do? Really what they're trying to say, I think, is, who are you? Tell me who you are. And the idea is, in the modern West, that somehow our identities are very neatly pegged to our jobs. And though that's sometimes true, for a lot of people it's not true. For a lot of people, the name on the business card, the identity on the business card, is not the identity we really have. And a far fairer question would be, what do you like? What do you dream of? What do you want to do in an ideal world, but maybe you're not doing now? But we find it hard to bear that distinction in mind.
As you interviewed so many people in so many different walks of life, and we'll talk about some of those, how many of them were satisfied with what they were doing?
Well, I think that a frustration that I kept coming across was people who were saying, often people who work in large organizations would say, what's the meaning of this? And I think what they were trying to put their finger on was the way in which, when you work in a very, very large organization, it's quite easy to lose sight of, as it were, whose lives you're touching. I think one of the things we really want from work is to feel like we're making a difference to somebody else's life. We somehow manage to help them, either by reducing their suffering or increasing their pleasure, but in some ways, anyway, leaving them better off at the end of the day than at the beginning. And sometimes in the modern corporate world, in the modern industrial age, we're so separated out from people that we can be in a back office processing, the insurance forms to a, complex transaction that we don't even understand or see, and we can be very alienated from, as it were, what the whole business is about. So I think this is a really major problem, as it were, in the, in the modern, complex, hyper-efficient world that we live in.
As the world has gotten smaller because of globalization, because of technology, has it made this ability to see the impact of one's work any more apparent than it might have been 50 years ago?
Well, it's odd, you know, because as the world's become more interconnected in a kind of logistical way, it's also become a lot more mysterious. You know, 100 years ago, we used to know where stuff came from. You often used to have a personal relationship with the people right. whose goods and services you consumed and to whom you sold your own goods and services. Nowadays, we have a lot more that's available to us, but we don't know where it comes from, which leads to feelings of guilt, alienation, a loss of a sense of wonder. You know, look around your room, try and, you know, where did that chair come from? Who made that light bulb? Where's the electricity coming from? We find it very hard to understand these questions. And in a modest way, what I was trying to do with my book was to stitch some of these missing links together, just to try and trace back some of these journeys, some of the way in which these ordinary commodities that we rely upon are so mysterious to us.
On the other side of that, what price have we paid emotionally and personally, psychologically, for not knowing, for having this disconnect from our environment, essentially?
I think we've paid a very high price, and it comes out when you scratch the surface of what people are doing, and you say to people, what is it you fantasize about doing? And if they're dissatisfied, they'll very often come up with answers like, I'd love to run a small shop, or I'd love to run, you know, a bed and breakfast, or I'd love to, own a small vineyard, or something that's somehow small and has a direct contact with people. I think that most of us find it very, very hard to kind of deal with the anonymity of the modern workplace, the way that we are in contact with quite a small group of people, even though our work may be touching thousands or even millions, but we don't see them, we don't understand them, they may be in different countries, and that is a very odd way, and I think that a very deep impulse in human beings is to serve other human beings. You know, when you look at how children play, mm-hmm. Very often they'll play a serving game. They'll pick up a tray, they'll put some objects on it, and they'll circulate among the grown-ups, and they'll want to give them things. And there's a pleasure in that. There's a pleasure in kind of playing the waiter. And even in adult life, there's that very strong desire to serve and to see another human being who you're serving. And the conditions of modern work very often deny us that pleasure.
Is that something, though, is that human instinct something that is exploited, for lack of a better word, by those that manage those giant corporations for the benefit of the corporation, not necessarily for the benefit of the individual?
That's a kind of tricky political question, really. I think that all workplaces exploit things in their workers which they're not really paying for. If you're a parent, you will know that you pour into your child all kinds of reserves of love and energy and commitment that will end up in a grown-up human being kind of siphoned off for the benefit of a corporation, so that an adult worker is the result of so much labor that the employer has not really paid for. All kinds of goodwill and kind of free energy, really, that a worker puts into their job. I would say that the modern corporation benefits an awful lot from having people who are basically quite nice. You know, most people are eager to please, compliant, eager to work in a community, and that can definitely be exploited. Of course it can.
You looked inside a number of industries, and one where there seems to be one of the largest disconnects between what people do and those that consume it are the biscuit manufacturing plant that you looked at.
That's right. I was looking at this sort of giant cookie factory. What interested me there was the kind of disconnection, I suppose, between the meaning of the occupation, you know, baking a cookie, and the size of the organization. This is a billion-dollar industry employing thousands of people across manufacturing sites all over the world. And yet what they're doing is essentially something that, a grandmother does in her kitchen, but they're doing it on such a scale that it assumes a kind of weight and importance. And I think that's a feature of many modern jobs, that they're essentially things that, we used to spend an afternoon doing, that now have become, sort of corporations of such gigantic size that there's a kind of solemnity, a seriousness, on there. And all this I wanted to explore in the realms of the Cookie Factory.
Mm-hmm. One of the areas that does touch people in a profound way that you talk about is working in aviation. Talk a little about that, Alon.
Well, I think that when we think about what the modern world is, it's almost symbolized, it's captured by aviation, the aeroplane, the airport. These are the places, again, if you had to take a proverbial Martian and try and show them where the modern world is, you'd probably take them to a giant airport. This is where it's happening, as it were. I was intrigued by that whole world and looked at the world of aviation, particularly looked at the way that aviation dates. One of the things that we all have to come to terms with in our working lives is the fact that we are going to go out of date and eventually die. But this is very little spoken about, and when you're in the middle of your working career, you don't have much time for that. You know, you're up against the present moment, you've got the challenges of the present, and you don't really think about retirement or whatever. I wanted to look at the way that the airline industry is one where there's a lot of focus on everything being young and new and fresh, but things actually fall apart quite quickly. And I went to visit in the Mojave Desert, this most amazing site just outside the town of Mojave, where aeroplanes go to die. This aeroplane graveyard where all the kind of relics of civil aviation go from all around the world. So you've got these rusting, decaying 747s and other airliners. And it's a fascinating place to kind of look at the way in which our very modern, pristine world does kind of collapse after a few years. And so, yeah, that was it's a fascinating place to go and visit.
You also looked at the realm of rocket scientists.
Yeah, I wanted to look at the way in which technology really influences our lives. I wanted to look at the admiration one can have for pieces of high technology, and yet also the way in which most of our lives cannot have the elegance and swiftness and rationality of the kind of high-tech world. And so you can become terrifically in awe of technology, but then have to come back to earth when you realize that you can't lead your life that way. So I went to hang out in French Guiana, and I went to watch the launch of an Ariane rocket as it was putting into space a satellite for a Japanese cartoon channel. And it seemed, again, to be a moment where the whole modern world was kind of coming together. You had Japanese technicians in the middle of the South American jungle in a territory administered by France, a satellite for, teenagers that was being produced by some of the cleverest people on the planet. There just seemed all these kind of incongruities that I wanted to explore.
What realm of work that you looked at seemed to be the most deadening in some respects?
Well, I think what always depresses and kind of saps people's energy is whenever they can't be in control of their lives. And the modern tools of management are often very suspicious of personal initiative, or at least want to kind of put a neat box around it. And I think the challenge for all organizations is, how do you keep the individual spirit alive and yet keep the entire group moving in a coherent direction? And very few organizations have worked this out. And I went to spend time with the human resources departments of various large organizations. It was fascinating. I mean, in the olden days, the motivation of workers was simple. All you needed to motivate your workforce was a whip. You just hit people harder if they weren't working hard enough. And that's how, most of the world was built, through labor that was essentially being hit and frightened to perform better. Nowadays, we can't do that. And workers have to be engaged. They have to kind of fall in love with their jobs. Otherwise, they're not going to do them properly. And that's a real challenge for management, and it's a real challenge for workers. And I was very interested in exploring that.
How do we get to this point where people feel that they need to fall in love with their jobs, they need to find meaning beyond the economic incentive in order to appreciate their work?
Well, you're right to hint that this is a kind of new phenomenon. I mean, for most of human history, the idea that you would try and enjoy your job rather than simply use it as a tool of survival would have been completely strange. I mean, you just worked in order to live. And I think even nowadays there's almost two visions of what work could be. There's a kind of older working class vision, which is work is for survival, and your real life goes on with your family and your friends and in your spare time. And then there's a more modern, you could call it a middle class view, that the meaning of your life is work, and that's why you should work a lot, not take too much vacation. Your colleagues could be your best friends. You could pin all your hopes in that. It's interesting that at the very time when this idea takes hold in the West, a similar idea emerges around love. For most of human history, the idea that you might love the person you would marry was considered completely strange. You wouldn't mm-hmm. marry someone for love. You married them just to bring up the children or to hand down the family farm or whatever. Suddenly, in about the middle of the 18th century, a new idea comes about. You could actually fall in love with a person that you then go on to marry, i.e. you could have pleasure and necessity. And the same idea is work with work. Work might not just be a way to an income. It could be a way to fulfillment and creativity and self-development. And we are, as it were, the heirs of these two great ideas, love and work. We put them right at the center of our dreams of what a good life is, and these dreams regularly let us down, which is why we limp from career crisis to relationship crisis to career crisis. Some of us get it right. Some of us have the perfect relationship and the perfect job, but it's unlikely. And I think what I wanted to do was to examine how we got to this point and whether it's perhaps sensible or not to be here.
And the other part of it is that since this is a concept of modernity, as you say, that both of these things are, that they are also subject to change, and there are factors going on even now that could shift the emphasis away from these ideas.
Absolutely. The world is very fluid, and we've been seeing in this recession all kinds of new or perhaps old ideas come up to the surface again. One of the quintessential ideas of the past century or so has been the idea that you get what you deserve in your job, that we live in a meritocracy. In other words, a society where those who are energetic and clever and talented get to the top, and those who are less so sink to the bottom. And that's been the kind of driving motor of politics and economics. But what we find, particularly in a recession, is people questioning and saying, well, hey, can that really be true? Do people really get what they deserve? Can that be true? And we see, again, well-meaning people, corporations that have got their heads screwed on, nevertheless coming to grief. And that's led a lot of people to question that meritocratic idea of work and to aim for a slightly more nuanced view where maybe people don't get exactly what they deserve, for better or for worse.
And, of course, as a result, managing people within the context of the modern corporation becomes a much more difficult task.
That's right. When you have highly ambitious people who are sacrificing an awful lot of their lives in order to take on a certain job, you're really, dealing with human lives. You're playing with fire, and that's why unemployment is such a serious business. That's why management, the managing of people, is such an arduous a job, so difficult, because nowadays we don't have such strong family ties. For many of us, we don't have religious ties. Work is in the middle of our life, and when that goes wrong, the whole of us goes wrong. And so that's a huge responsibility that we've put on ourselves.
Of course, what it also leads to, as you point out in the book, is a greater interest in entrepreneurship, in being one's own boss.
Yes, this is, of course, the great fantasy of the modern worker, to be able to, as it were, own the fruits of your labor and direct your time and make sure that you don't get fired arbitrarily or you become the victim of some kind of office politics. Of course, the statistics on entrepreneurship are pretty sobering. When you actually talk to venture capitalists or people who know about this sort of thing, something like 98% of all new businesses will fail in their first year of operation. And yet we live in a world where our heroes are people like Bill Gates, people who've started with a bright idea and have managed to build it up into a multi-million dollar corporation. It's a beautiful idea, but it's a remote idea. And again, I think it's worthwhile just examining what we're trying to get at with the idea of entrepreneurship and whether it's a sensible ideal to put forward as a kind of something that might legitimately happen to all of us. Maybe it's time that we realize that it's a reality that's only going to come true for a very limited portion of people.
And as a result of that, as a result of the fact that the statistics are so overwhelmingly against you, that the fact that people continue to do it really speaks to some of the frustrations and sorrows in the larger workplace.
I think what it also hints at is the incredible adventure and irrepressible nature of the human spirit. You know, we are up for adventures. You know, all of us have a side to us that is pioneering. All of us have a side to ourselves that prefers excitement and danger to safety and boredom. And it's almost miraculous and almost admirable the way that very cautious people and cautious corporations and banks will occasionally step outside of the norm and just pour an awful lot of money into a particular cause and more or less light the match and throw it in with the cash and watch the whole pile disappear into smoke. And as I say, it's almost beautiful. It isn't, but it's almost beautiful because it's connected to a side of human nature that otherwise is very valuable, an ability to make a sacrifice, occasionally to be impulsive, to do something, you know, grand and big-hearted, and all of these things which are very valuable.
And those are the things that enable people to keep showing up every day, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, we've got this very dual-faceted nature. At one level, we're creatures of routine and safety who are able to submit to incredible disciplines. And, you know, the modern office is an incredibly disciplined place. At another level, also able to, embark on adventures. There's the whole of human history in the modern workforce. You know, we're the species that hunted for a living for most of our lives on this earth, for most of the species life on earth, who've known incredible danger, but who are also creatures who developed farming, who settled down, who knew the pleasures of the homestead, who knew the pleasures of routine. So the idea of the hunter and the farmer, these are dichotomies that still exist in the modern world. There's a little bit of those two things in all of us.
Alain de Botton, his book is The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. It is just out from Pantheon. Alain, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure.